Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
I hear breathing, but...
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, and I hung up on myself right before my one-year anniversary show started. So, Eagle One, did you step into the gap, or we have a bunch of dead air?
No, there was some silence and heavy breathing, but I think a lot of people like the heavy breathing, so it's okay.
Well, just to know that we're all human and it is a live show, I'll blame one of our guests who will remain nameless, Jerry. Anyway, I wanted to welcome everybody aboard our inauspicious start to our one-year anniversary of Midrats. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my ever-genial host and occasionally surprised major host when I hang up on myself, Eagle One of the blog Eagle Speak. A special note today, we're going to have, instead of a one-hour show, we're going to have a two-hour show with an expanded panel. That's going to include some of our former guest hosts and regulars, Galran, Brian McGrath, Jerry Hendricks, and Claude Barabay. As a reminder for those who are joining us live, please, if you can, join the chat room. You can find that over at the bottom of the page. If it's not up and running, it will be in a couple of minutes as I make sure that's working just fine. If you have some questions and observations you want to share, Eagle One will be writing her over in the chat room. We'll try to fold those in as we go forward. But it's going to be a fewer questions here and a little more talking because of the format that we're going to do. We're hoping to get through at least 8 major topics today. But as usual with our conversations, we never know where they're going to wind up. And if you're a new guest to Midrats and you want to hear some of our previous shows, please go over to Blog Talk Radio. You can get the archives there, or you can subscribe to the podcast over on iTunes. And before we get going, because we do have people here that work for companies or on active duty, I just wanted to put a general disclaimer for everybody out there that their opinions are of their own, not their company they work for or the company they keep. And so here we go. On with the show. Before we get started with the questions, we've had a real loyal audience here, and I wanted to thank everybody who's been on the chat room with the usual suspects, has helped promote the show, and who at the last minute have agreed to come on as guests or offer a few ideas on where we should go. And our first question today, kind of throwing a curveball at a couple of folks that weren't completely pre-briefed. Though his schedule is rather busy and we couldn't arrange to actually have him here in person, I offered up a couple of emails with Admiral Stavridis, the Supreme Allied Commander Europe, and I just asked him with the panel we had today if he had an opportunity to ask us a question for a change, as opposed to having pontificators ask him questions, of what would it be? And so I'm paraphrasing a bit, but here is the first question, and I wanted to, it wasn't directed at Galran, but Galran, I want to ask you to go ahead and take this for the initial response, and here's a question. And I paraphrase, beginning, what is the next big idea for maritime operations? In the last half decade, we have seen 10th Fleet come online and cyber rise along with sea-based anti-ballistic missile technology, and not including that are the standard answers about power projection, humanitarian support, sea control, strategic deterrent, and sea lift. But looking towards the 21st century as it unfolds, what do you see as the next big idea for maritime operations?
No pressure. Okay,
You know, when I first heard this question, I started thinking about technologies in terms of the non-kinetic technologies that we're going to see emerge over the next, say, decade plus, probably two decades. And that would include the all-electric drive and extended power for battery systems and things that would extend existing capabilities. But as I think about the question and the way you framed it, I would say it's going to be how we operate our forces in terms of what we have expectations of a single ship doing. And let me explain. You're talking about mediums when you say ballistic missile defense. You know, this is how we're now talking about ships that can shoot targets in space. And in cyber, you're talking about your medium being cyberspace. At sea, what we have typically seen from a ship is that you have your shooting ranges and your operational ranges, and you have the ability of your helicopters, and that's the extent of your range where you're able to provide some sort of physical presence. But I think what we're going to do in the future, the next big thing, is to think about the way our ships are able to occupy more space at sea. And by that, I mean it's going to be a combination of unmanned systems and manned systems so that they can influence greater areas of sea with fewer platforms and do it just as effectively as you would do with multiple platforms. And it's a challenge to connect those dots. And by that, I mean we're going to have deployable systems, and we need to be clear that we're talking about platforms and systems. Platforms will be your ship, and systems will be something that goes off board. And in previous eras of maritime development, we have seen this capability. Currently, we see it in the aircraft carrier and in our amphibious ships. But I think that this is something that we're going to have to see in our combatants. We're going to have to see it more in terms of what our logistics capabilities are. A logistics ship is going to have to be able to support logistics for multiple ships that are spread out over even greater ranges. And a lot of this is going to make our ships bigger, more expensive, but at the same time, they're going to be more capable when they're concentrated, but very capable when distributed. And these are concepts that we haven't had to address. We're only starting to look at with the emergence of concepts like the littoral combat ship. It's unclear whether that ship will ever be able to fully realize those concepts. But that's what's over the horizon when I look at what the future of maritime operations are. And I'll give an example being the drug trade that we see coming from South America to the United States in the form of these submarines that are essentially disposable. We have to be able to create underwater nets that are enormous, potentially as much as 100 nautical miles wide from a single vessel. And these nets are going to require interconnecting systems back to your platform that can then inform command and then connect to other platforms and other systems and build yourself a network at sea that is more interconnecting but has more endurance, has more longevity than what we're able to provide today. I think that's where maritime operations are heading, because it's going to have to be we're going to have to control the seas in terms of taking control of the seas with a combination of unmanned systems that act as our systems and potentially our payload delivery capabilities, as well as our detection capabilities. But you're not always going to be sinking every single target. You're also going to require a human presence, so you're going to have to figure out ways to sustain presence from smaller groups of people from a platform, and maybe that's in the form of high-endurance ribs. You know, you start going down that line, it starts thinking about, okay, what does your platform have to look like in order to support these smaller platforms that do 48 hours at sea independently and, you know, sometimes may have to endure, you know, sea state 3 tough conditions. So that's where I see maritime operations evolving towards, and a lot of that is financial pressures. But a lot of that is also how we can look at incorporating our technologies, because the oceans are getting bigger, they're getting more populated, more so than at any point in history, and the amount of commerce on the oceans is becoming more valuable over time as well as trade continues to interconnect global economies to one another. So we have to think about how we sustain our presence, both in terms of just our ISR, but also in terms of our visitation, and then also how that works within the context of the Law of the Sea and other treaties that define engagement at sea during peacetime.
Claude, do you have a couple minutes of thoughts on the subject?
Yeah, I'm going to go in a slightly different direction than Galran, although I agree with him on a couple of issues. And the way I see it is that in the 21st century, with the increased population along the coastlines, I think we're going to see increased destabilization of smaller states. And I think with the comparative recession of U.S. maritime power, I think it's going to result in more and more what I've called before the shadow zones, which are not the undersea warfare shadow zones, but geographical maritime security gaps that are largely in the littorals near a failing or belligerent state where navies have or no navies have the strength, experience, or authority or possibly even the interest to secure. I think we're going to see an increased use of commercial platforms as a result from non-state actors, non-governmental organizations, and corporations using the sea, particularly in littorals, again, because of the expense of the platforms. Again, going a little different direction from where Galran was saying, we need to buy the platforms will be a little more expensive. So that's where essentially where I see it going.
Sal, this is Brian McGrath. Sal asked me via the chat room to pop up if you ended Claude, and he wasn't back, and so I'll throw my two cents out here. I think it's ironic that the question that we are answering was teed up by Admiral Stavridis, because my answer was posed by Commander Stavridis, and that is, I think, the most important place where maritime operations are going is going to be a closer alignment with the Air Force. I think air-sea battle as a concept, in order for it to have any real effectiveness, will encompass two primary facets. The first is that the Air Force and the Navy will increasingly have to co-evolve systems, and they'll have to put aside the whole concept of not invented here, adopt each other's technology wholesale, and certainly integrate it. Secondly, I have a sense that in order for air-sea battle to work and a closer alignment of the Air Force and the Navy to work, command and control paths and command and control organizations will have to alter. And I truly believe we may begin to see some sort of a hybrid command and control organization, an air-sea battle-inspired command and control organization that enables this anti-access armada of both tools and thinking to have some sort of effect on the 21st century battlefield. Back to you, Sal.
Okay, Brian, you have a couple minutes to talk.
That was just me.
Oh,
that was just me.
I'm sorry, I was off and I've come back. Jerry, do you have a couple of points to build off the previous conversation?
Well, I mean, to retrograde back to the Admiral's previous or original question, you know, kind of coming back to where are we going, you know, I think it's I think everyone's kind of touched upon it, but where it's driving to, and we need to recognize this, is a balanced force that has an ability to operate in both the high-end capability and then into the low-end, because to dovetail off of Claude's statement, you know, you need to get back into the shadow zones, which is to say that we're going to need to get back into the littoral, into the contested areas that we've abandoned due to our own shrinking fleet. And so we're going to need to develop, you know, technologies that allow us to go there, be it with unmanned that would have long-term sustainability in the area, long-term presence, or we're going to need to go with a force that's smaller, cheaper to purchase, and hence more numerous for us to maintain our presence. Are the allies and people in the world that we're working with want to see us, and I mean they want us to be seen. They want things with gray holes, white numbers, and red, white, and blue flags flying in the waters in and around their backyard to offset the other people who are beginning to compete with us within the international maritime realm. And we know who those are, and we can get to that later. And so I think we're going to see the technologies push us to increase our presence in those realms. And I think to dovetail off of what Brian just said, we're going to need to work more effectively with our partner services, be that the Air Force, be that with the Coast Guard. Oddly enough, we're seeing the Army try to get on board and find some niche in the air-sea battle construct. I think the Marine Corps have actually done a great job of finding some hooks into that where they can assist. So I think that that's the direction we're going, and that is the direction that the Admiral is already looking if we look at the work that he did previously at Southcom and that he's continued to look at in UCOM. So I think that we're going back into the littoral, but we're defining it better at this point in time than we did in the 1990s.
Eagle One, you have a response for 2 minutes, and then we'll give you the next question to direct to Claude.
Well, I think that the points, the reason that there is some, it seems to me that there's some doubt about the direction, is that we really don't have a national policy about what we're going to use our Navy for, even where we're going to go. There's a big debate over whether or not we're going to be, it seems to me, retreat to a defensive, we're a land-based power and we're going to sit here and let the world come to us, or whether we're going to continue to project power worldwide. And if we're going to do the latter, we're going to need a different naval structure than the one where we're going to, if we're going to sit back and rely on the oceans to protect us. And if we've abandoned, just to a large extent, our efforts to police the oceans of the Navy, and I have serious doubts as to whether we're going to continue the policy we have the last 50 years, we're going to see a different Navy structure, because the policy is different. The policy is going to drive the strategy, and the strategy is going to drive the equipment. Assuming there is some coherent policy that can be formulated by the parties that are presently in power as they vie for dollars, and the two worldviews of the parties are so different that it's difficult to see a coherent policy come out of that. One man's view, but. Among the other things that have, this is a more recent question, is going to come as a surprise to Claude, but Claude, out of the things that have happened recently, what leadership lessons do we see that we should learn from Captain Honors and a little touchy subject, the people who were above him and in the food chain? Where are we going with that kind of thing?
The way I'm going to answer that is I'm not going to question how they responded to Captain Honor's videos from via chain of command. I'd like to kind of take a step back and look at it from a broader public perspective, and that is the issue of standards for the Navy versus standards for the general public and the media and policymakers. And I think what we've seen here are two standards. Peggy Noonan recently wrote, I want to say it was a day or two ago, in the Wall Street Journal, how yes, we are held as Navy officers, Navy in general, as sort of a cut above or a cut different than what is expected. She compared leadership, and if you haven't had a chance to see this movie, by the way, The King's Speech, which was absolutely phenomenal, and how the second in line for to become king had risen to power, and how he approached it. But here's what people, I think, don't understand generally in the public, is that there is nowhere like the Navy, or, and I will argue, the rest of the military, where you can lose your job or your rank for obesity, for adultery, for lack of physical capability every 6 months during a physical readiness test, or in word usage or how those are applied, even via the internet on YouTube or whatever medium you want to pick. I think it's because we put up our right hand to uphold and defend the Constitution. We understand
that we have limitations in terms of free speech, but also in terms of conduct that we're expected to uphold. By the same token, I think what we saw with Captain Honors is actually very much no different than what we would have seen, say, on Saturday Night Live or Jon Stewart's The Daily Show, both of which, in fact, Jon Stewart's Daily Show is far more influential among Americans 18 to 25, based on the recent numbers, in terms of news. And yet some of the words and the actions that Jon Stewart uses are things. But granted, he's not a commander of a U.S. Navy ship. But I think we've also seen that the court of public opinion is far more immediate and severe in its indictments and punishments in the military. And as a result, those are acted upon, those incidents are acted upon far more quickly and severely than they would be in public. When you look at, and again, I want to be very careful here about, I'm going to talk historically about policymakers, not the current policymakers, speaking from a historical standpoint only, where we've seen legislators who have done the same things that we have, and ostensibly they are leaders of our country, but it is a different standard. And I think what the biggest lesson in this is that we have to understand and accept that we have that different standard to live up to.
Brian.
I'm glad that Claude mentioned Peggy Noonan's editorial this week in the Wall Street Journal, because after I read it, I had put out a couple of things here and there about this issue, and I basically said that he knew he was wrong, that he should be punished, but that removing him from command was not what was called for. And I believed that, and I still believe that. But Peggy Noonan, in 750 words, embarrassed me. And she embarrassed me because she displayed more knowledge of what it is to command a Navy ship than I accumulated in 21 years in the Navy and certainly in 2 years in command. Her description of what it means should be something that is put on the wall up in Newport for everyone to see who walks through those halls on their way out to command a ship, because I truly believe that she captured the essence of command by explaining that it is a position that's just different. It is a place where the incumbent should not seek to act like everyone else. And that was the great failure of Captain Honors, is that he acted like everyone else. He acted like his viewers. He acted like his crew members. He wasn't in command, but he was close enough. And so I think she really hit it, and I'm glad you mentioned it, Claude.
Jerry, 2 minutes?
Yeah, first of all, let me kind of start with this from sort of the top down on this. And I want to talk about this from my personal experience. As an active duty guy right now, all I can tell you is my opinion on this, as opposed to a direct critique of Captain Honors. When I reported on board the Theodore Roosevelt as a lieutenant, I met the commanding officer of a supercarrier, and he was larger than life. And as a lieutenant, I think most captains are. That being said, who ultimately became Admiral Ron Christensen, was larger than life. The man stood about 6'5", and he had a majesty about him, and he was very careful about protecting the dignity of his office as the captain of that ship and as a captain in the United States Navy. This was something that was a rarefied position. He did not come down and mingle with the common man. And yet we all treated him with reverence and respect. And I remember the first time I went to Captain's Mast accompanying one of my sailors who had wandered into a difficulty. And the admiral or the captain came in, and he was in khakis, pressed khakis with starch and his aviator's wings shining. And he wore his combination cover, and as if he needed to be any taller. But he brought the full majesty of his office into that, and he impressed that upon not only that sailor, upon me as well. And ever since then, it's always been in the back of my mind that if I was to ever attain command, even commander command, or the rank of captain, that I would attempt to hold myself with dignity and not to diminish the office in any way, because it was an office that I revere. I mean, this is an office that goes back to John Paul Jones, to Bainbridge, et cetera. You get the sense of the history that comes into play here. And so, from my own personal standpoint, I'm imperfect, as I know, but that's something I think we all should aspire to. And I'll tell you another thing, too, and this goes back to a conversation I had with someone who is in my neighborhood but is not of the service. And then talking about this topic, I said, I think that we should do everything we can to retain the respect of the general public. And they said, yes. And do you know why that's important? And I said, well, it's because we're your officer corps. We protect the country. They said, no, we trust you with our children. We send our children to you voluntarily as families in this country, and we know that you will lead them into harm's way, and we expect that you will lead them in the best and finest manner. We expect that you will be an example to them. And so I think it's incumbent. The reason why we're respected is the American people think that we will take care of their children, and if we expend their lives, we will do so with great thought and with great respect. And so I think we have to carry ourselves in that manner.
Gallen.
I'm not sure there's much I can add to what the panel has said or to what I've already written on the subject. The Navy holds its commanding officers, its leadership, at all levels to a higher standard, and I'm okay with that. I think that the Navy holds itself to a higher professional standard, and they all understand that. So as long as you have a clear understanding, it's laid out in Title 10. There are a number of ways you can look at this professional standard as being higher. Peggy Noonan's article is an example. As long as you're not a banana republic and changing the rules on the fly to accommodate situations like Captain Honors, which it would have been, in my opinion, a rule change on the fly to accommodate a situation, the Navy's right, and they've done a good job. I commend what Admiral Harvey said. I think that since it's really been over the last two decades, the Navy has changed the professional standard for their leaders, and they have held their people to that professional standard, and everyone is aware of it. No one doubted that the XO of a ship, the responsibilities that he has in the situation and what he did was wrong. It's not a question of whether it was right or wrong. It was how the Navy was going to handle it. I have no second guessing on how the Navy handled it. The only thing I would add from my perspective is that if you look at the introduction of, and it's not really an introduction anymore, but you have all of these technologies like YouTube, and I would use Scribd as a good example. If you're going to write a PowerPoint, a PDF, if you're going to put together a video, hold it to a standard where you feel like it, that whatever that presentation is, whether it's video or any other sort of medium, the media accurately reflects the professional standards that you would want your company reflected as. It's a policy that we have I work in a state government agency. It's a policy we have is the YouTube standard for video. Do not produce any video that you feel would embarrass our organization on YouTube. Do not produce any PowerPoint presentations or PDFs that you feel would embarrass our organization. And always keep in mind, I deal in healthcare a lot, so we are always thinking in terms of, make sure that anything that goes public in terms of a presentation reflects all of our policies in a way that is professional. And that's something that the Navy can address. And I actually have spoken with Dennis Moynihan about that. And it's something that the Navy can do. I was most impressed by the officer corps who they themselves seemed to understand that this was a professional situation where the guy was not in bounds. He stepped out of bounds. And they hold themselves to a higher standard, and they seem very comfortable that he was held to that same standard. So for me, it was one of those situations where the Navy did the responsible thing, what it must do, and as an outsider looking in, I completely respect that.
Gal, you brought up a couple of points are still in line with what I've been thinking, especially since Monday. I think, Admiral, the decision about whether he should be relieved or not, I think, was taken care of when Admiral Harvey made the decision that he made, and it kind of ties into the three big takeaways that have come back to me since then. The first is Admiral Harvey as very interesting that you can have a four-star at his position who will go, and it ties into the comment you made about the digital age. He will go online, and his flag writer did not write this for him. He did not outsource this to a double-digit SIN code or J code over at Fleet Forces Command, and say he went on his blog and he said, this is the decision I made. This is why I've made it. And he's let people comment on it. And he had a follow-on to that, which I think is kind of setting a template on how we communicate in the larger Navy community. And I think what we also saw with these four-year-old videos is a snapshot of a tech air subculture that very few people understand, is very difficult to explain, and that officers of a certain age, saw it all over the place when they were junior officers, if you ever got near a carrier or at a bar somewhere, that had mostly disappeared. And I think it's the end of that tech air subculture simply because it cannot survive in the digital age. Things do not stay within the skin of a ship. Things do not stay in the O Club. And in many cases, things do not stay at your friend's house where you have eight couples getting together over the weekend. There's just, it's going to be a change that's going to have to take place for all the reasons that a lot of people here identified. I think the larger story here, and I think we're going to hear about this when Admiral Harvey's investigation gets complete, and I think everybody should get out of his way and let him do his work, is, as everybody who's been on the carrier knows, you are not going to do something like that and not have the commanding officer being fully aware of it, probably commented on it, and the senior officer present afloat, embarked, is going to know about it and is going to see about it. And I think the investigation's detail on that will be something that we'll just have to wait for, but I think it'll be very interesting to see. And I think we'll put down as an opportunity to put down a marker that was there if people wanted to read between the lines, but will be a lot firmer on, you know, before you do something, take a deep breath and think about, will this look good 6 months after deployment is over with? And this is sitting there on PBS, something to ponder. And a question, next question I have, I want to direct this over to Brian to answer. If it kind of builds off this, there was an article in the Atlantic by Tim Kaine that came out last week. And you can kind of see articles like this written every few years or every time there's a crunch going on in the military. It's titled, Why Are Our Best Officers Leaving? And he basically, he breaks your fresh batch of officers into three groups. Your hard-running, entrepreneurial attitude individuals who mostly disappear here. And you have your middle group that mostly stays, and then what some of my colleagues also call the oxygen thieves, who can kind of take up a lot of the white space until they wash out one way or another. Just if you could give an overview about what is that decision matrix with some of our smartest and brightest junior officers that when they're given the first chance to punch out, they take it and go. Brian, can you hear me? Can anybody hear me?
I hear you.
Yeah, I hear you. And
okay,
I saw
Brian's
trying
you?
To get back on the bridge.
Okay, well, I tell you, Jerry, we're going to pick on you. If you wanted to pick that up and give us a five-minute response, and then we'll let Brian fold in behind you once he gets back.
I don't know if I can go full 5 minutes on it, but, you know, I read that post. I found it to be very interesting. And it was, as I'm sure that you understand, Sal, it's very similar to what I experienced, you know, throughout my early squadron tour and even through department head tour and looking around the, for me, the P3 squadron and trying to see sort of the breakout there. And you're right. You know, the first time I came across this idea of the Navy not really having room to break out sort of the ultra-fast mover, or in my mind, not just the bright guy, but the innovator guy, the person who thinks sort of very quickly, very tangentially, and very out of the box. was in reading some of the writings of Ross Perot and the his understanding and frustration with being sort of the navigator of the Pacific, selected as a very junior lieutenant, JG lieutenant, as the brightest bridge officer in the Pacific at the time, but yet realizing that even with that type of recognition of his professional prowess at sea, they weren't going to accelerate his promotion. It was still going to be, you know, promoted on time, and he was going to have to spend his years at the additional ranks before he was moved on, and then ultimately, you know, he would never made lieutenant commander. He chose to get out and get into business, and then what he did with EDS, I think, is pretty emblematic and representative of what he was, the potential there. And also, if you look at from my own community, if you look at Chris Michael, who left the Navy, left the P3 community, and then went out and founded, you know, military.com. Where he was able to take that to great success and then, you know, capitalize it and ultimately sell it. You know, I think that there we sort of recognize sort of these three grades, and what tends to remain over time is generally that middle level, the person, sort of the solid performer over time, who becomes, you know, essentially the professional of the corporate profession, and we lose sort of the top end and the bottom end sort of falls out as well. I think in the end that has harmed us to a degree in the latter half of the 20th century, in the sense that we've gotten very comfortable with who we are and our professional identity. And for that matter, we've become very comfortable with us as a profession, almost of engineers and technologists, that we have these systems that we take to sea or these systems that we fly. And I think we've lost touch, again, this is my own opinion, with sort of the historical, somewhat the social science type approach to leadership and understanding our profession. And there's not a lot of people who think deeply on topics of history and of strategy. In fact, one of the frequent criticisms that I hear now in my present position is that even at the senior officer rank, that we have a number of people who are very comfortable at the tactical level. We have a number of people who are comfortable at the operational level, but to go beyond that, to go to the idea of multi-formations and sort of the broader joint arena, there's not a lot of people who have thought very deeply about that. And I think Admiral Stavridis is one of the few that sort of stands out. There's a number of others that I could stand. He's not, you know, a singular. But I think that there is a problem that we have in that there isn't room for the rapid advancement. Now, there's a reason for that historically. You know, seniority had its place, and even when we did the reforms at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century to sort of get rid of the elderly deadwood that was kind of clogging up the promotion system, we still wanted to set a pace so that we kept young men fleeting up to command, knowing it was a young man's game, but at the same time we wanted to have that constancy that we knew who was going to be around us and that you didn't have sort of the flash in the pan. I think, in a way, Sims sort of ruined it for a lot of people by being so brilliant that he scared a lot of the senior officers at the very time that a lot of these reforms were coming along. And so I think, you know, I think that that description of our profession and sort of the demarcations of the various different levels of it is pretty accurate. I do wish that there was more room for the young innovator to be accelerated, but at the same time, do you really want to trust a 32-year-old with a supercarrier? I'm not sure that there's room for that level of acceleration.
Brian. Hello, Brian. I think we've lost Brian again. Galloway, do you want to pick it up for a couple minutes?
Yeah, I can pick it up. I'm the outsider, so I quite frankly will not answer the question whether or not the Navy is losing its best talent. I think it's an interesting question because wherever I go, I find people have that they believe it. And I'm a big believer that perception can be reality when everybody believes it, although I'm not sure that perception is reality in this case. It is a question that everybody asks, and that is why the Tim Kaine article, as soon as I saw it, I sent it out to a lot of people. And I wanted to write about it on the blog, but I realized that I'm the wrong person. I thought about having Brian write about it on the blog, but he was the wrong person. So what I did is I've gone out and solicited articles as best I can from active duty officers. So, for example, Commander Michael Younga wrote an article on my blog on Friday, and I have Herb Carmen will represent the aviator community tonight, and I'll run that so that everybody can read it tomorrow. I've already had a submission from a lieutenant commander who is going to take over command. I don't remember if it was he's selected for early command of a minesweeper, perhaps. But the point is, it's a topic that a lot of people think about, a lot of people talk about, a lot of people believe is true. Maybe that makes it true. I'm not convinced. I don't know. I do know that when I look at, I mean, if we're talking about professional development and the way that people go about their business, I tend to find that what happens is as people who stay basically within the blue track and they don't go into, like, joint operations and joint staffs and joint commands in terms of a focus, and they stay more along the major command and blue track, there is more of an operational and tactical thought among the OPNAV folks. Whereas, and this was a result of Goldwater Nichols, in my opinion, whereas the joint folks tend to think a lot more strategic. Maybe it's just a combination of their experiences. But so the question I have is that once somebody goes joint long enough to pick up all of this strategic knowledge, are you able to bring them back into OPNAV and make that a seamless transition? I think that's something that may not get covered in this topic, but I think that might be part of the perception. Another way I would look at this particular, the Tim Kaine article as it relates to the Navy is officers in general, in my opinion anyway, they have a tendency to believe that their experiences are very similar to other experiences because they are able to find people with similar experiences. But the bigger net that you cast, the more you find that maybe it's not always the same. So it could be that within certain percentages, you find that you're not necessarily losing the best. You just the perception is that you didn't grab as many of them as you could have. A lot of the way the Navy does professional development early on is statistical based. A lot of the way promotions take place is statistical based. I think that one of the ways that you can address this is looking at how you can kind of break down the statistical categories for people in like so many percentage is going to get a promotion from this particular block. Maybe what we need to do is create smaller blocks so that we're able to refine the percentages a little better when it comes time for promotion. For example, you may have a block of 150 guys and you're going to take, say, 50% of them. Maybe we need to make that two blocks of 75 guys and take 50% of the two blocks. There's a lot of different ways that you can refine the way that we do our statistical promotion activities in the Navy and potentially find it's better. The only other issue that I see in terms of this conversation that to me strikes me as relevant anyway, I think I lost my train of thought, so I'll come back to that if I think about it.
What broke your chain of thought was the screening from the people who run boards over the million came from. Brian, I think the third time is the charm. You got a couple minutes on this subject.
I think you checked up. Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you just fine.
Great, perfect. First of all, the article by Tim Kaine in the Atlantic Monthly is basically the same article that was written about 3 or 4 years ago about the same problem. The exodus of mid-grade officers from the United States Army is due to one thing and one thing only, and that is nearly 10 years of continuous combat. The United States Army, there's nothing that ails the United States Army right now that 10 or 15 years of concern duty in Germany or back at Fort Riley won't cure. I look at the people. Do great people leave the Navy and the Army? Absolutely they do. I remember as a JO who had decided that I was going to stay in for a career. I remember being crestfallen at some of the guys that would stay, and I would look around and I would think, my God, I wish this guy would leave and this guy would stay. The bottom line is the Navy doesn't need that many superstars. It just doesn't. I mean, there are 10 four-stars. I retired at 21 years of service, and I used to look around at my the friends who stayed, and I thought the quality of those guys, even after 21 years of service, the quality of the guys that were left and the difficulty that any board would have in trying to pick one above another in terms of their professionalism, their expertise, their ability to think, it would be a tremendously difficult job. The second thing I want to talk about is this sense that the United States Army has somehow become a strategic thinking organization. Tom Ricks likes to peddle this, and it's absolute rubbish. Because John Nagle and Petraeus have raised counterinsurgency theory to the level of grand strategy, at least in a press that doesn't know the difference and doesn't ask good questions, leads people to believe that the Naval Officer Corps is somehow lacking in strategic thinkers. I think this is just bunk. You look at any three star taking a battle group, taking a fleet, a two star in a battle group command is in charge of a strategic asset. A division, an Army division, is not a strategic asset. It is an operational asset. Its movements are from one geopolitical boundary to another. A fleet moving across geopolitical boundaries is signaling the entire way. It's a level of strategy that's just born into the United States Naval Officer, and it is something that we do better. It's part of our culture, and I think that's why we have a lot of naval officers in very important positions today.
Claude.
And that's all.
Yeah, I actually want to piggyback off of something that that Jerry was talking about earlier, and that's innovation. And about 43, 42 years ago, Vincent Davis wrote a theory on how innovation happens in the military, and he suggests that it comes from the mid-grade officers. And after I was reading this, I was kind of curious about something, so I needed some sort of data set, and I went to a hard copy of proceedings starting from 1875, and I went right through 1919. I just kind of did some tabulations. And the thing that I found most surprising was that for the first 25 years, 80% of the contributors from the military to proceedings were 04 or below. Now, granted, during that time, promotion was slow. You had the lieutenants and lieutenant commanders were like me, a little older, a few more gray hairs. But the same, what you saw in the 1910s and 1920s, was that there were more senior officers writing, and most of those had written as junior officers and mid-grade officers. So if you're looking at the reformers, whether it's the 1880s and 90s or the people like Matthew Perry and Stockton and Maury in the 1830s who advocated changes to the organization from the Bureau of Naval Commissioners, the Board of Naval Commissioners to the Bureau system we had for about 150 years, who introduced really advocated for the steam warships, with the more senior officers opposing this. I think if you really target these junior to mid-grade officers, these hard chargers that Jerry was talking about earlier, and try to find ways to have some sort of incubator or either at Naval War College or right after Naval War College, or give them some sort of command at sea. But the only way we can do that is if we start building a smaller class of ship, like the PCs we have. If you have that, then you can give some of these hard charges some real skin in the game and really prove what they can do. Brian's point is right on target that we have some excellent officers around, but I also remember a lot of officers on my ship, ship drivers and pilots, who I was really sad to see go after just a tour or two, because they were some of the most phenomenal people I've ever encountered, and I used to watch them operate, and they were just absolutely incredible. So I think we need to start incentivizing these best and the brightest 03, junior 04 level folks somehow. And I think that's one way to do it.
Jerry, before we head on over to Eagle One, I believe you had a quick response to something that Brian brought up.
Yeah, you know, I have to put in just a note of dissent there. I'm disappointed, actually, at there are some officers who clearly stand out who have an ability to think strategically. However, I think that given the training and background and the exposure, as he correctly says, we send out battle group commanders, and they have to operate across entire regions. What surprises me is that when we get them back and we see them both in staff jobs as well as in some of the war games and exercises on their way to Major Fleet Command, that they're and I see this on a sort of a routine basis, that we don't see sort of the strategic depth of understanding where naval forces, and for that matter the joint forces, fit in the overall broader strategic arena. And one of the things that strikes me, and I've written about this as a critique, is that, you know, we seem to the major sticking points of the wickets that we're looking for senior flag officers to go for is the ENCODES and going through the N8 organization and looking at requirements and the idea of being able to fight the battle of the budget as opposed to fighting the broader strategic thing. I've read Major General Scales' critique. I believe that the Navy should be producing more strategic leaders than what we presently are, and I think the system is not rigged or not correctly organized to do that, to force strategic thought or to weed out strategic thought and strategic leaders. We have very few strategic leaders at the senior grade.
Eagle One, you have a couple minutes on this topic, and then another question for Brian.
Well, as one of the, I think Claude and I, maybe the only reserve officers who were on active duty and left, and then know why we left, you know, the problem with being a junior officer on board a ship is that you're up to your elbows in work all the time, and it keeps your focus pretty narrow. And if you're an intelligent person who believes you can do a lot more, it's difficult to get anybody to take you seriously as you look at the broader scheme of things. And that's very frustrating to bright, coherent people. But the problem isn't limited to the United States Navy or the Army or the military alone. It is also a problem in industry. You know, you get bright people in a law firm, you get bright people in a corporation, and if you don't treat them, give them the authority and responsibility level at a level where they can handle it, they're going to leave you and start their own law firms, their own corporations, and that's how innovation gets done. It's very difficult to do that in the structure of the Navy, particularly since we don't have too many lieutenant commands. We don't have those lieutenant JG commands. Maybe the Coast Guard does it better. I don't know, but it's a challenge to try and get those people, that kind of person, into a job where they can really succeed. Want to stay on the job they're doing, and you know, I don't know what the solution is. I know that when I left, it was out of frustration with what I was doing and the fact that I seemed to be deployed all the time and you know, missed my family. But it's a difficult challenge. My question now for Brian has to do with ballistic missile defense. Brian, pontificate for a few minutes on where we should be on ballistic missile defense.
Okay. I believe that the answer to coherent ballistic missile defense at sea lies in something I think Gowron was mentioning earlier, which was the effective networking of forces. I think the air and missile defense radar planned for insertion into the DDC-51 follow-ons will be a very capable radar, but at the end of the day, it does not bend the surface of the Earth. It is subject to the laws of physics. There's a considerable amount of the flight of a ballistic missile that it won't be able to see. The future of ballistic missile defense is a highly networked, architected laydown where overhead assets run by the Air Force, sea-based assets obviously run by the Navy, air air-breathing assets run by both the Navy and the Air Force, with a whole range of new weapons that will be able to intercept missiles in flight, and ships that are principally high-power radar ships. We've got the Cobra Judy platform out today that will be fielding a radar that is significantly more sensitive than anything floating right now, and there's a solution here, or at least part of a solution, that says we network Cobra Judy overhead assets, Aegis, F-35, F-22, everything you got, so that missile defense becomes more of a networked, architected issue than a sensor-to-shooter, all-on-one-platform kind of issue. We're very comfortable in the Navy thinking about detect-to-engage sequences where I get a contact, or I get some gouge on a contact. My radar goes out and finds them. My radar goes out and fixes them. My combat system develops a targeting solution. My weapons control solution sends a missile out towards the contact, and there is a magic that happens within one platform. The future of ballistic missile defense is that these sensor to shooter links have to be broken. That a missile can be shot by an Aegis destroyer that is driven home to endgame by an AWACS or some sort of an airborne command and control system. This architected, integrated, networked way of ballistic missile defense is going to be one way that we make sure that we don't get on the wrong end of the exchange ratio here. There are lots of scenarios in which the other side has a lot more missiles than we have interceptors. An elegant battle management system that ensures that the platform with the best shot, the highest probability of kill, is what is taking the shot, and that what is shot at it makes the bit most sense. This is what we need out of our ballistic missile system. There is a question about sea-based ballistic missile defense and its impact on allies. I would suggest that we need to really grasp and embrace this mission, because this is one way that our forward-based forces demonstrates resolve to our allies, especially in East Asia, who I think are increasingly beginning to wonder whether we have the same resolve. And putting the money into high-end ballistic missile defense and to sophisticated ships networked in an elegant architecture, I think that's where we need to go with ballistic missile defense, and I hope I've filled my 5 minutes.
Yalen.
I would second what Brian said about the network, I think there's actually two tracks to fielding an effective ballistic missile defense from the maritime services perspective or the joint services perspective. The first is you're going to build resilience within that network that allows you to capture and do the intercept and tracking and all of those various components, understanding the launch locations and trajectories and all of those. There's a lot of pieces. But the other track in terms of ballistic missile defense that I'm kind of keeping an eye on and I believe is going to emerge as an important area in this is you talk about the non-kinetic technologies that the nation, but also the Navy, is engaged in the development of. And some of this includes how are we going to start utilizing different technologies like laser systems. Jamming systems is a big-time component of it. A lot of these systems that including these missile systems that fly long distances, their weakness is that they use a lot of computerized components for that precision targeting and updated communication and all of these various pieces I think that there is a big opportunity for disruption long before you have to pull out your interceptor and engage it as it's coming towards a target. And I'm looking at ballistic missile defense from the perspective of how do we create battle space disruption with our non-kinetic technology development, including jamming systems, blinding systems that prevent them from targeting us in the first place. And I think that this gets into a lot of the cyber capabilities that we'll be looking at in the future, but there's a big space there that ballistic missile defense seems primarily focused right now on the kinetic kill option, but there's the non-kinetic kill option that I think has a huge opportunity that makes this weapon system obsolete before it's even fielded.
Jared?
Yep, two things. One, I think you got to split the ballistic missile threat into two groups. One that's very near and dear to us, the idea of this anti-ship ballistic missile, which is a particular threat that's directed at a particular target in a particular arena. And then there's the larger threat, which is the idea of the ballistic missile, both in its nuclear warhead form and more being talked about and seen around the world, the idea of the conventionally armed ballistic missile, which is something that we're not ready to deal with, mostly because we're precluded by treaty from having discussions about that. So to separate those things out and understand that you have one in the maritime environment, which essentially is an anti-access and area denial type of technology, we're going to need to try and look at that, either pulling back the platforms themselves, in this case the aircraft carrier, which that threat is principally directed at, and try and keep it outside the threat envelope while perhaps creating a platform that can be lodged on that can go through the range, hence getting outside of the threat range, but having an offensive platform that can go the distance through that threat envelope and still be able to hit the critical centers of gravity. So that's one thing that gets you back into the battle. The other thing, too, is just to move away from the aircraft carrier paradigm and force your opponent to direct his weapon against a much larger classes of ships, in which case that brings about greater reactions from the international community and allows you to also go to different types of technologies. Another thing that you can look at is countering it by simply going with a low observable platform to be your principal strike weapon. The submarines and the use of Tomahawks, guided cruise missiles off of submarines, has been a way that we've been operating for years, although we haven't been able to do that in mass. But I think the Ohio classes that have been converted for SSGNs, as quiet as they are, give you an ability to operate inside that envelope. Now, conventional ballistic missiles that could be directed at land or strategic targets, on shore, that's another thing where we're going to need to look at this equation, this monetary equation, about the cost of the number of to produce the missile versus our cost to defend. And Brian's correct. We are upside down in that equation. And I think Galron's correct. We have to look at things like directed energy. And I think directed energy works both on land, where you have access to tremendous amounts of power. But we need to look at those platforms that we can put at sea that can also generate tremendous amounts of directed energy. Presently, our mainline ship, which is the Arleigh Burke-class, doesn't have a lot of excess, although there's some promise that we could be able to put some extra power on there. I think the Zumwalt classes, the three that we're going to have, would be excellent platforms because they were designed to have the Ergum gun on there, and so they have a tremendous amount of excess power that we could do a lot of experimentation on to develop those. The other idea that is out there beyond directed energy is actually a kinetic potential that's very cheap, which is continued development of the Ergum. I think what we're seeing right now with the electromagnetic catapults on the carriers and the advances we're getting there, that we may be able to get back ahead on that technology and have some sort of a inert metallic round that we can project very quickly at large distances with a great deal of accuracy as we work on timing and sort of GPS-like things so that the ship would know accurately where it's at and be able to track with the radar to know accurately where the target is. But that would be a very fast kinetic potential. So I think that there's something there that we're going to be able to get back ahead of this, either by avoiding it, by going under the water, or or anyways are just trying to find our way around the problem.
I think you're spot on. The promise of a greater electronic generating capacity, I think, over the next few decades gives us some additional options to address this threat. But I think if you're looking right now, the next decade, what can you do? I think the path that we've taken towards expanding sea-based ballistic missile defense really gains us a lot of things that can help you address some of your known unknowns. It has great flexibility, mostly from a political standpoint and the fact that where they're located. And like we learned, we built those beautiful air bases in Libya just because something is a great location in year X, politics can change in year Y. Also, from a tactical and operational standpoint, it's great flexibility. Relative survivability that you simply do not have in a fixed land-based location where any Mark 1 Mod 0 Cessna 172 can take out your phased array when you least expect it. There's a fair bit of scalability and some flexibility and commonality because of the launch cells and the radar you're using. But in a larger sense, for this show, we've come to the top of the hour plus a little bit. We're going to take about a 2.5-minute break. So please stay right here. We'll be right back when we're done with the cruel sea.
This is a story of the Battle of the Atlantic. A story of an ocean, two ships, and a handful of men. The men are the heroes. The heroines are the ships. The only villain is the sea. The cruel sea. That man has made more cruel.
Like now, number one. It's the firmest contact we've ever had.
There's men in the water just about there.
Well, there's a U-boat just underneath them.
Attacking, stand by.
Target moving quickly right, sir.
Range 200. Range 100.
It's the day it took off, sir.
Kind of war, number one. The people in it have got different, too.
In what way do you mean?
Oh, at the beginning, there was plans for all sorts of things. Understanding people. Making allowances for them. Now the war doesn't seem to be a matter of feelings anymore. Now it's just a matter of killing the enemy.
These diversion jobs nowadays, don't we, sir? Sort of compliment, I suppose.
Pretty cold one.
Cold night, too. Cocoa's just coming up, sir.
Gilbert!
Sir!
Call up Cyprus on RT, plain language. Say torpedo 15 miles astern.
Aye, aye.
Welcome back, everybody, to Midwraps. For those that may be joining us a little bit of the way through, I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my guest host, Eagle One from Eagle Speak. And we're doing a one-year anniversary show with our extended panel of former guest hosts and regulars, Gowron, Brian McGrath, Jerry Hendricks, and Claude Berrabay. And before we took our little break at the top of the hour, we were talking about BMD. And I wanted to shift from the near future to something that we're doing and talking about right now that is going to impact the near future with what really is going to drive, unfortunately, most of our decisions. And that has to do with money. It has to do with finance. And, Gallery, I'm going to direct this question to you for a five-minute response, and then we'll do our usual, everybody else gets a couple minutes to respond from there. Is one of the great reading materials that came out, let me check my date stamp on here, came out on Tuesday, 6 January. SecDef Gates put out his entering argument on some cost savings and some directions for the Department of Defense. Personally, I found two of the more interesting items, both some of the personnel changes he wants to make, but there's also some rather significant impacts on the Navy and the Marine Corps team. Gowron, I know you've had a chance to look at it. What are some of your thoughts on the proposals that SecDef Gates had?
I see it as a first step, and we can look forward to more. I think that the most interesting thing that was revealed when he announced his initial changes is that he's not retiring. And I could have told you that. I think everybody who's been paying attention could have told you that. His intention is to reset the DoD in a different direction than it has been on since the wars began following 9/11. And this is just kind of the next step in that process as I look at it. It asks the questions, where are we and where do we need to be going? And you have to account for where we are before you know where you're going. And right now we are an expanded ground force with, the Bush administration added more brigades to the Army. It added more Marines to the Marine Corps. It reduced the number of ships. It has changed the nature of the Air Force. I think the Air Force is still has some problems that have to be addressed, but for the most part, there's all of this is in motion, and Gates came out with specific recommendations. Now, if we look at a few of them, I will look at what his intent is and then what he did. For example, he mentioned that he wanted to flatten the organization of the Navy, and by that he's going to reduce the Navy's Second Fleet Command. He's going to basically deestablish the Second Fleet. That's one way to do it. It's a little bitty change. I don't know that that's going to make a significant difference. I think that one of the things that I would look at doing, if I was just taking a holistic look at the naval command structure, I would look into maybe combining Pacific Fleet into their tasking authority, shift it all into Fleet Forces Command so that you have only a single tasking authority within the Navy for ships, as opposed to one on each coast. I think that that's kind of a next step that needs to be done if you want to truly flatten the Navy, because what that does is it streamlines the work that gets done in the Pentagon when they have to go out and they're preparing, say, if you take the example of a humanitarian mission, they have to work with certain people over here in the East Coast for tasking a humanitarian mission, and they have to work with a different group of people and repeat the same basically work. They do everything twice. You should be able to just do it once, and you should be able to do it once with the same groups in the same rooms, or even if it's all on the same phone line. Those type of things, I think you can flatten the Navy's organization a lot more than just by de-establishing a single fleet. The reduction in the Marine Corps does not surprise me. I think that one of the things we're looking at doing with the Marine Corps is to re-engage what the Marine Corps will bring to littoral operations. You cannot conduct littoral operations without forces on ground. That goes back to ancient Greece. If you remember when the Tritomarans were fighting each other along the coast, whether it was Sparta and Athens or Athens and the Persians or whoever it was, there was always a Marine Corps group that was landed first so that they could provide support from land. I think we need to get back into that mindset where the Marine Corps is going to provide support from land for our littoral operations, no matter what they are, when we are engaged in combat. So there's a lot of thinking that is going on. I am of the belief that the Navy is looking and moving in the right direction, and I will pull at 3 points. The first is we have to reestablish stability into our industrial base. This is critical. And the littoral combat ship is one step in that direction. If you think that in 15 years you are going to be in a naval race or in some sort of naval competition with another power, that you have to find creative ways to expand the workforce. And with the littoral combat ship, they have not only increased the number of people who are building ships, but they have increased the number of people who are working on the auxiliary components of ships, including combat systems and things of that nature. So you have to expand your workforce in creative ways under budget restrictions. And I see the littoral combat ship as one example of doing that. Another way is you have to find ways to put more budget into R&D. We are at that threshold where there's a lot of technologies that are new. We see the electromagnetic launch system on the carriers. We see all-electric drive coming with the DDG-1000s. We see a drive towards unmanned technology and the necessity for alternative energies and more power and more longevity in our battery systems, and you can go on and on and on around these non-kinetic technologies that are going to emerge. They're going to first emerge in the DoD. They're going to be capitalized in different ways in the commercial sector. The reason I believe they'll emerge first in the DoD is because the commercial sector is right now is as disorganized as the government, so we'll probably see the DoD, who seems to have more organization in terms of their development than everyone else right now, except for in cyber, and I think we'll see the commercial sector lead government in that realm. The third thing that I think that what Gates is kind of pushing in terms of the direction is we're going to utilize and evolve existing systems. It will involve putting the new radar on, you know, reusing the Burke hull, for example. We have to be creative in that way, too, because we don't have the money for recreating a new type of a new hull from scratch. So I think that what they'll ultimately do is they'll try to reuse the TAKE hull for things. They'll try to reuse the LPD-17 hull for things. They'll try to reuse the Burke hull for things. We're just not in a place right now to build new. The flip side of that is you have to be looking towards all of these new technologies, because if you believe that you are potentially going to have some sort of naval competition or naval race that is going to come at some point in the future, by expanding your workforce and expanding your R&D, it will put you in a position where you are able to more rapidly field technologies when you decide that you need to get engaged in the race. And that will encompass, I believe, being able to field, say, like frigate-type ships quickly if we need that. It will be able to field smaller aircraft carriers if we need to go that direction. It will allow us to field major combatants if we need to go that direction. But we'll have all of the internal technologies like all-electric drive, electromagnetic catapults, these new gun systems, our advanced combat systems, our interceptors, all of these little R&D systems that are being developed will be more of where the focus is as we take advantage of our lead. Now, our lead, and I noticed that everybody talks about whether or not it's real, diminishing, relative. How do you put it in context in terms of what Gates is thinking? I think if you really look at the way the world is today, you have about a decade to figure out where we're going to be in 2020. Where do you want to be is basically the question. And I think that you have time to expand your R&D and think about these things, what the world in 2020 is going to demand, and have yourself in position. But the way you do it is by building as much little stuff as you can while focusing on your systems, technologies, your non-kinetic, in most cases, technologies, and bringing them up to space so that when it's time to roll out what's next, and that will be, you know, as the cruisers are retiring, as the destroyers are retiring, whatever that new platform is that you field, will be in the best position possible. And I think that's what Gates is trying to do. He's taking away a whole lot of money from some areas so that he can be prepared to reapply them back into others. If there's real budget loss here, it's going to be minimal.
Jerry, do you have a response?
Very quickly, because apparently the phone's about to die. I'm going to say I think we need to not only revitalize the industrial base, we're going to need to expand it. We need to get more companies out there competing in shipbuildings, which, again, is one of the reasons why I think it's important for us to go with building a different type of Navy that is more broader, has smaller, cheaper things that can get more shipyards and, for that matter, more congressional delegations interested in what it is that we do. I think that Gates is trying to flatten the Navy, and I think the decom of Second Fleet is sort of a first step. And I agree with Galron. I think that we could look at, you know, just as Atlantic Fleet has gone away, you know, PAC Fleet could go away and fold that into Fleet Forces Command. I think Third Fleet could go away, as well as I think the lead-follow relationship out there with Air PAC and Air Lant, the junior admiral, those pairs, be it subsurface or air, those juniors need to go away, and the seniors need to take the responsibility for managing their communities. We have almost, I think we have more admirals than we have ships. And, you know, we ran the Navy for the first 100 years with no admirals and all captains. And I think that we're going to need to get the balance back there and making our leadership face up to the sort of the overabundance that we have of them. The last thing I would say so far is Senator Gates' initiatives is I think he is trying to force us into a different Navy. I think he's raised questions about the viability of the aircraft carrier in the future. I think we need to follow up on that. I think we need to reassess the basic core mission of the Navy. For 60 years, we've assumed its power projection. I think we need to have that debate and look at the other missions that are out there, naval presence, sea control, and how important those will be for us in the future.
Ryan.
A couple things. I think anyone who believes that Mr. Gates had anything to do with folding Second Fleet under Fleet Forces Command is confusing cause and effect. I think Mr. Gates gave the services targets and then to some extent let the services figure out what they wanted to do to meet their targets. And I would be shocked if the Secretary of Defense or his staff had really anything to do with offering up certain levels of command. I think the Secretary of Defense clearly indicated that he would welcome moves of this kind, and his own getting rid of Assistant Secretary of Defense for C3I and getting rid of Joint Forces Command, I think he was showing the way, and I think he was basically tempting the services to come forward with faint-hearted approaches, which the Navy didn't. The Navy came forward, I think, with a pretty good way of looking at how to flatten things. I mean, and I'm a Second Fleet sailor for most of my career. I used to wonder why, in God's name, there was a Second Fleet and a Carrier Group 4, the training carrier. It just shocked me that we would do that. So the concept of flattening the hierarchy is a good one. By and large, Mr. Gates is doing a wonderful job of attempting to get his bureaucracy ahead of the bow wave. He is ensuring, to the extent possible, that he beats OMB and the Congress to the punch by forcing some tough medicine on the services. I think it's, by and large, pretty good. I was particularly happy to see him pick up one on something that I've written quite a bit about, which is the health care costs and by proposing to raise premiums on fat retirees like myself. That he's going to do that shows some courage. It shows the courage of a man who's going to probably not be in office that much longer. But it is a good thing for the system. I think the Marine Corps had a serious shot across its bow when the Joint Strike Fighter is on probation and the EFV is on its way to its death. It means to me something I actually wrote about on the blog earlier this week. It's time for the Marines to cozy up next to their Navy buddies, and I would suggest that it is equally in the Navy's best interest to cozy up next to its Marine Corps buddies. But by and large, it was Mr. Gates' cuts were the work of a master bureaucrat, which I mean, and it's only positively, doing a very good job to get ahead of the bow wave.
Claude, you have a couple-minute response.
Sure. I want to go back to something that Galron said, and I think he was when he was mentioning the industrial base, the importance of the LCS for that, and I think it was Eric Wertheim who came out with a report or answered a query in the media that said, yeah, this is one of the, it's not the only reason, certainly, but it's one of the major reasons why we want to continue LCS. But with regard to R&D, I think we need to be really careful on over-relying on military development of R&D. You know, certainly it has a role in 6-1, 6-2 programs and a few others, but the private sector is really, you know, a robust private sector is absolutely crucial, and I think Galron pointed that out as well, to an effective and innovative R&D. I mean, when you look at the real game changers of the first 120 years of the Navy, when you're looking at the steamship, whether it's the steamships of the 1840s that were developed a couple of decades before that by the commercial sector and had already been tested out in transatlantic runs by private companies, or if you look at, say, I think it was the Olympia in the 1890s that was the first ship built with electricity and refrigeration units. So I think we've got to be really careful about, you know, absolutely investment in R&D is absolutely important, but we run the risk, having lost a lot of our manufacturing base and a lot of our jobs overseas. And as a very quick point I want to make about education, actually, because there was a couple of years ago there were 64,000 PhDs awarded in the United States, and of those, only 16,000. That's 1/6,000. We're in computer sciences, in engineering, and a couple of other things, like mathematics. All right. So of that 16,000, most of those, 70% of the engineering ones, were foreign students. So we're training people for innovation, but we're not training our own folks, because a lot of them are going back to their home countries. So let's be real careful about that. I absolutely agree with what Jerry said about broadening the industrial base with regard to shipyards. We've got a lot of small shipyards. What happened right before World War I and World War II, and the only way we were able to expand quickly was relying on our industrial base. And there are a lot of small shipyards out there that have never done DoD work before but might be able to work in cooperation with us, whether, you know, for new and innovative methods, whether it's the folks doing composite hulls up in Maine or a few other places. And very quickly, getting back to the big picture on the budget, I think these are some important cuts, you know, stuff like consolidating staffs, cuts to contractors. But consider this. This is a drop in the bucket to what the budget is or where it needs to be in a few years to be any effective. I think it's great that DoD is absorbing some of these austerity measures if they are a shared pain, but I don't think they're a shared pain. Just perspective for just a second. In 1960, over 70% of our federal budget was discretionary spending. This decade is going to be about 30%, of which defense is the primary thing. So large cuts, you could absolutely cut out most of the defense budget, and it really won't have a major impact on the long-term deficit. Over to you.
Eagle One, next question to you, directed over to Jerry.
I have a question that relates to Fords, Ferraris, and the use of combinations of ships for influence squadrons. And I'm going to tie this, or I'd like you to tie this, to how we could use our NATO and other allies to use their ships and such forces. And how do we make this all work, Jerry?
Okay, well, I appreciate that. It's a great question. It's obviously one that I'm interested in.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Look, you know, so far as, you know, the influence squadron idea, when I teed it up, was because I thought that we need to be able to drive and get larger numbers to be able to operate in areas that we were receding from, and that these areas were becoming unstable because of that. And when I say unstable, I mean in the sense that we have created this rule set in the maritime domain, and we have administered it for most of the last half century. But as the Navy shrinks and our presence has decreased in some of these areas, that rule set has begun to erode,
and in some areas we've seen piracy start to creep up, and in other areas we've seen other powers begin to try and attempt to apply their own new rule set to those areas. And so I think we need to get back there. And so that's one of the reasons why I wanted to drive to a smaller, cheaper platforms that we could buy in greater numbers to be able to go out there and get the size of our Navy back up to somewhere around 350 is what I think that we're going to need to be able to be the places that we want to be. Now, you raised the question of how we can look at some of our allies and partners to do that. I'm all for incorporating them in. The problem that I've seen, though, over the time of my career, be it in Yugoslavia back in the 1990s or even with Iraq and Afghanistan, is that allies have a vote on whether they want to participate or not. And if you're going to be dependent upon them, i.e. in the chairman's thousand-ship Navy idea, to be able to be all the places they want, and they suddenly decide that, look, we don't agree with that mission, and they choose to withdraw those forces. And if that particular aspect of the force has a very specific and important support role, meaning what if we turned over mine warfare or countermine warfare to the Allies? Look, that will be your niche. And suddenly they say, well, look, we don't want to participate in the exercise. Where are we at that point in time? And so we need to be able to retain a span of capabilities across the spectrum of warfare in order to execute the missions that are important to us as a great power, as the superpower in the world. And there are a number of nations in the world that depend on us to be that superpower. And so I think that we need to incorporate them. Certainly we'd like to integrate them, and we should write our doctrine and our TTPs to leave holes for them in these influence squadrons, as I can see now. But at the same time, I cannot be, in my own mind, dependent upon allies and partners, because in the span of my career, I've seen too many of them decide to stay home. And I know that there's always the importance of building a coalition and making sure there's consensus in the broader international arena. But there are times that the United States has preeminent interests, and you need to be able to execute those interests, support them with or without the support or the requirement of support of someone else. And so I think that we have to move forward. We have to build the Navy larger. We have to look for opportunities to do security force assistance and building partnership capacity type missions with local regional actors, and certainly bring in some of our allies at the upper end from Europe if we can, and from some of the other people who have begun to develop a Navy, on par or near par with some of our own. But at the same time, we have to retain an ability to act autonomously to uphold our national interests. And I think that's about it. I'll turn it over.
Ryan, you have a couple minutes on the same topic.
Yeah, I do. When we wrote the maritime strategy, I don't think I knew Jerry Hendricks then, but the concept of the influence squadron was very close, I think, chronologically to that, or came out soon thereafter, and it fit very well in and fulfilling the two separate employment character schemes that were talked about. There was the regionally concentrated credible combat power and the globally distributed mission tailored forces, and I don't know if Jerry saw the influence squadrons as largely in the latter. We created that document, and we announced that document in the fall of 2007, and I think about a week before it was announced, the Dow hit 14,000 points. We made our assessments were growth at or about the level of inflation in terms of budgets for what we could count on for resources. I've since called for a reevaluation of the maritime strategy because I think we either A, have to get a greater share of a smaller pie, and that is to more vocally advocate for the centrality of sea power, which is something all of you hear me do all the time and probably get sick of me doing, or we become a smaller Navy, and a smaller Navy that concentrates on those things that we and only we can do, which are the high-end power projection, ballistic missile defense, killing people and wrecking things stuff at the expense of low-end influence missions. I don't want to do that, but nor do I want to peter out limited resources on limited on missions of limited importance to our national strategy. I'd rather concentrate on the things that we and only we can do. And I think that's my 2 minutes.
Gal, you have a couple minutes response on the topic.
Several months ago, I received a contribution from Lieutenant Commander Benjamin Armstrong that discussed the creation of an influence squadron with an international feel. And I believe I posted it to the United States Naval Institute blog, and I wish I could recall the name of that particular blog post because it was an interesting read, and it gave an example of how to do that in the Asian littorals. It's an idea that I think has a lot of merit, internationalizing the influence squadron concept as a building block. But I would caveat it like this. We have not seen in the last few years any measurable progress from task forces that are international in flavor, and I would use Task Force 151 as an example. Task Force 151 is, of course, our joint international anti-piracy task force, and it has contributing members from Europe. It has contributing members from Asia, Pakistan, India, not India, but Singapore, Turkey, I believe, is responsible for it today. There's been France has contributed. There's been a lot of various countries contributing. But the success rate for curbing piracy, if we measure by hijackings, has not been very good. So when you start looking at the success rates of international task forces, you have to start questioning whether or not there is a success rate when you have so many disparate policies at work, and whether or not it's even possible. I think the only way you're going to be able to prove or disprove this concept is by looking at NATO and saying, okay, we have a mandate. This is a NATO mandate, and I would probably use something low-level like piracy as an example, that you have to be able to form a coalition solution to meet. Now, even if the solution is just to say, 20% cuts in the number of hijackings for 2011, that's your objective. It's kind of a step-by-step process, but can you even achieve that with an international task force? And I remain unconvinced. So I'm not sure. I mean, it depends on where you want an influence squadron to operate. If you want it to operate in terms of a true security mechanism against a legitimate problem, that's probably a lot different than, say, a soft power capability like the deployment of a hospital ship or some sort of medical diplomacy armada, if you will, to a strategic location and hitting five or six countries. I don't have a particular favor of it, but I would like to see NATO take the influence squadron concept, run with it, and try to address a specific problem. That way you can see where various nations can make various capabilities, contributions, and we can measure results legitimately, as opposed to the theoretical value of international cooperation.
Galvin, you've made a perfect lead-in to the next question I'm going to ask. I'll back up a second here. You made a point about, make something a NATO mandate and hand this over to you. One of my most emphatic critiques of the whole thousand-ship concept come from my background in Afghanistan, because in 2005-06, that's exactly what happened. Afghanistan was given to NATO and created ISAF, where they moved out from RC capital and then went northwest and south and eventually east, though really the U.S. kept RC east to themselves. And with that, what happened in NATO, we could spend hours talking about caveats and everything else, and also what we have seen in the Horn of Africa with the various ships. We had one of the commanders on board here talking about, hey, I have 22 ships, of which six I can really use. that we need to take a sober view of having allies come on board. And here's my next question that folds into that is, since the 1950s, the cornerstone has been NATO. And NATO has always been a very delicate creature, but especially now, being that many of the member states do not reach the 2% of GDP threshold. Plurality of them are actually below 1%, 1.5%. And when we look at especially our traditional ally, the British, and what has happened to the Royal Navy, whether it was completely getting rid of their maritime patrol aircraft or the fact that if they're lucky, they'll get one carrier that may or may not have any F-35s on it. And because they're smaller, their national missions will always take priority over NATO. And there's also significant political and economic risk, as Portugal, Ireland isn't part of NATO, but Italy is, Greece. These nations, including especially Spain, it has a pretty nice navy. Those economic impacts are going to take. We've also seen with Secretary Gates, we have downgraded 4-star billets to 3-star billets. We are continuing to decamp from Europe, which is something I've supported for years and rightly. So with NATO, is NATO really going to be able to be as big of a player as it's been since the fall of the Berlin Wall? Or do we really need to readdress how we do business globally because of NATO's weakened military and economic stance? Good question. I'm sorry. This question goes to Brian to answer for 5 minutes. Sorry.
Okay. NATO has been a bulwark of our defense for a long, long time, and it did a wonderful job. I wonder these days whether it is relevant to the security challenges, not because of the nature of the security challenges, but so much, but because of the nature of the regimes that play in NATO. Western Europe is safe. It's fat. It's happy. A level of anesthetized social welfare spending has created a way of life that people are very happy with. There are no real barbarians on the border. They seem to have done a relatively good job with our help in capping the festering sore that is the Balkans. You have a security apparatus built for a previous time that is largely run by the United States of America, however, with the aid and comfort of a bunch of regimes that don't seem to see the world the way we do. Our worldview, the worldview of the superpower, the hyperpower, the sustainer and enabler of the global system, is not a view that can be shared with other countries. NATO, the Great Britain, doesn't think that way anymore, and its population doesn't think that way. Spain doesn't think that way, nor does its population. We think that way. We continue to think of ourselves as the world leader, although I believe increasingly less so. And I think there are increasingly more tensions that on this sense of where we fit in the world. So I look at NATO and I think, my goodness, NATO's in Afghanistan, and Sal has reminded us of the issues of who can do what there. I think the Secretary of Defense's moves to downgrade certain commands, I think we'll begin to see more Army troops come out of Europe. I think NATO has served its purpose, and it serves a continuing purpose by showing what the what concerted action by like-minded democracies can do around the world. I would like to see a NATO-like organization in East Asia. I don't think it could be the extent that NATO is, because obviously NATO was created against a single enemy. I think this sort of collective security, guaranteeing each other's security, these are good things, and I think we ought to be thinking about where we can apply a model like this in other places around the world. I think the model that we take it from, though, the NATO model, is increasingly illegitimate—not illegitimate, but inappropriate to the the challenges that we wanted to solve, and quite frankly, the maintenance of a command structure the size of NATO to fight piracy seems to me to be a misappropriation of funds. And that's the end of my 5 minutes.
Claude, you have a couple minutes.
Thanks. You know, I agree with Brian that NATO has a very rich and successful history, one of the most successful alliances in history. But I think in the coming decades, NATO is going to really struggle for relevancy and potency for several reasons. First, is that it was founded on a shared immediate geographical threat that's either been largely mitigated or simply accepted, the issue of Georgia notwithstanding. The second is that after Afghanistan and Iraq have really calmed down, I think Europe's simply going to have less of an interest in distant wars. Europe has simply changed. When you look at when NATO was created, it was created in the wake of when most of the world was under the colonial control or influenced by half dozen or so European countries. So today they don't have that immediate interest in the far side of the world to the extent that they once did. Third, it's going to have fewer national security resources to address future threats. We've seen this, that the age of austerity in Europe is happening. We've seen what impact that's having. You said that most of NATO has 2% or less of GDP on defense. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think only the UK is 2% or above. I may be mistaken. There may be one more that's above. But they're not going to have the air or sea platforms needed for larger, even smaller scale maritime operations. Take, for example, the Royal Navy. Could they conduct another Falklands War today? And I'm going to go on a limb here on this fourth point, and that Europe's changing demographics are going to really result in a very different political landscape that's even less favorable to the United States. Now, immigration is a very good thing. We've succeeded in the United States with successive waves of immigrants, like my grandparents who came here for jobs and assimilated the American culture. But Europe has had a far different experience and climate. European birth rates have fallen below that 2.1 child per mother floor to replace its population. By contrast, they've got an influx of Muslim immigrants that is expected to be in the majority in several regions in a few decades. There was just an article in one of the British newspapers that said the most common name in England right now for babies, male babies, is Mohammed. And I think it's either in Brussels or one of the other cities where 5 or 6 of the 7 top names for males are Muslim. Now, is the fact they're Muslim bad? No, it's the fact that it's a completely different culture that may not necessarily be in line with U.S. interests. So for now, Europe is democratic. For now, Europe has very similar values. But even their own leaders, Angela Merkel of Germany, for example, said that multiculturalism has failed because they hadn't adopted German culture and values. And the final point I want to make is this. I don't necessarily agree with everything Secretary Rumsfeld said, and I think when he talked about old Europe, and it's in a different context of what I'm going to mention, but the future of geopolitical power in the world is not Europe. It's not in Western Hemisphere, but it's going to be in the Western Pacific, and as Robert Kaplan contended in a recent book, it's going to be in the Indian Ocean. So that's a major shift, and that's why I don't think that the future of NATO is particularly as strong as we would hope. Over to you.
Galvin, a couple-minute response.
I think it's time to divest our investments in NATO and start moving on towards the areas of the world that have the most influence which includes the Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific. I don't see much value in the maintenance of major military forces in NATO for long periods of time going into the future. I don't believe that NATO has a future in terms of the policies as they diverge between the what the government priorities are of the European nations and what the government priorities are in the United States. It'll be an interesting thing to watch. NATO is going to be a case study in how modern military organizations of international flavor fall apart. And I think that that's essentially what's going to happen. It's going to fall apart. I don't think it's going to be one of those cases where it lands pretty either. I think you're going to have a lot of people who resent the expansion that took place and ultimately the major contributors to the military power of NATO are going to end up going different directions. Europe is not going to be the same country or same continent that it is today in 50 years. It's going to be a lot different. I think Claude touched on the demography issues. There's also some economic issues. A lot of these countries, quite frankly, we don't know what the final outcome of the EU experiment is going to be. And I use the word experiment with capital letters. It's what is that organization going to be, and will it even survive the next decade of economic pressures? It's supposed to be economic-centric, and it has a checkered track record today. So we'll see how everything works itself out. But as far as I believe the United States should go, it's time to divest ourselves from NATO. There's still some uses for it in the war we're currently in, and looking into what is possible with international agreements, but otherwise, or international security problems, but otherwise, I don't see a real future for NATO at all.
Jerry, a couple minutes.
Yeah, I think that I've got to disagree. I don't think we're in a position really to divest of NATO now. One, we have a degree of dependence upon it for certain aspects. Second, we have a cultural tie with our Western European ancestry, in the sense that we need to be looking at NATO right now almost as a leadership challenge. And I think that Admiral Stavridis has been, as a Supreme Allied Commander, has been working very hard to justify to NATO those existence. And I think to a certain degree he's been having success. I know that they are understanding and looking at the challenge of Afghanistan as a hard challenge, but the fact is they are there. I think we need to make a better argument for NATO's place in the world, and I think that in and of itself is an argument about the United States' place in the world and the importance of our culture and our cultural outlook on international security. So I'm not really quite ready to walk away from NATO, even as I've become somewhat jaundiced in my own views about it and jaded in my feelings that I could depend upon them. So I think we need to go back to NATO with an argument about the importance of NATO. And I agree with Claude in the sense that NATO for a long time was about the defense of Europe, and now NATO has to become something else if it's going to remain important in the future. Now, on to the other subject, which he segued to, I do think that the greater international security concern is shifting to Asia and to the Pacific and to the Indian Ocean, and we need to get ready to move there and build organizations and friendships and coalitions there. But there is still going to be a security issue in Europe, and we're still going to need relationships there. My concern now is that we stand aside, we simply watch other cultures take over Europe and subsume the Western culture of which we are a part and which we draw a great deal of strength from. So I think that's a larger, grand strategic debate that we need to get involved in.
And Eagle One, we are coming up at about 5 to 6 minutes left in the show. I'm going to give the final question over to you. It'll be directed to Claude.
Yeah, let me pontificate for 1 second, which is I hate coalition warfare where the coalition doesn't have to make a commitment. And from my experience in the Balkans, that made things really hard. You never knew who was really going to step forward, or even if they stepped forward, who was really going to provide what they said they would provide. That being said, let me segue into the Indian Ocean, which right now seems to be dominated by what I've taken to calling the Somali Navy, which are the pirates using pirate vessels to expand their area of operations into places where there are no naval forces. Claude, what do you see the future of that being?
Same thing that we've been seeing over the past 5 years, the continuation of the growth of attacks and the expansion throughout the Indian Ocean. And when I was there 5 years ago, you know, the attacks were just along the Somali coast. But every year you look at those maps and they have just expanded almost all the way to actually they're operating now in the Arabian Sea. The costs are going to continue to increase. Yemen, for example, recently reported about $150 million a year cost to their fishing industry. Kenya said that it's about $200 million in shipping costs to them. The impact, however, you know, we've heard from Maersk that it's low impact for the commercial firms. But think about it. Let's think about it this way. What if they go away? Who moves into the pirate havens? Do we get Al-Shabaab at sea that's far more dangerous to global traffic? And that's what I've really tried to address over the past few years. If we can't contain piracy, then how are we going to address other interests who may use the same tactics, the same operational procedures, the same kind of platforms used by pirates? That's my assessment.
Okay, Gal, do you have a one-minute response?
What Claude said, basically, we have seen it extend all the way to the Maldives. We might as well just say that we can expect it off Diego Garcia pretty soon. I mean, the expansion across the Indian Ocean suggests that maybe we need to be asking questions regarding whether the Indian Navy is in any place ready to take control of the security of the Indian Ocean. My argument would be they do not seem to care. They don't see it as a problem. And the industry does not see it as a problem. So this will be a problem that is motivated primarily from industry interests. And until the dynamic changes from piracy being a non-lethal, mostly, monetary problem, until more of a lethal terrorist-type activity problem, we're unlikely to see any changes from what we've seen in the past.
Jerry.
Yeah, I think that one of the concerns I have is as Gal is right, that industry doesn't see this as a problem. One of the reasons they don't see it as a problem is they're willing to pay the premium or, for that matter, to just go ahead and settle up on a lot of these things. I think that to recognize and deal with piracy as opposed to confronting it risks the degradation of the international system and the free navigation of the seas. And so, and not to mention, I think we actually have a constitutional mission to counter piracy wherever we're at. So I think we have to go there ourselves. We have to work with international actors over there. And I think now is the time, even from a larger grand strategic viewpoint, or certainly a competitive strategic viewpoint, to partner with the Indians and try and develop that relationship and to develop them as a Navy, increase their confidence in us, and certainly try and work with them to build up their capabilities so that they can become a power in their own backyard and provide some stability and security there as we continue to focus in the Western Pacific.
Ryan.
I think Jerry's citation of a constitutional mandate important in that piracy and its mitigation is something that a major Navy must always take on. It's the table stakes if you want to be the big boy. And so we can't continue to say, well, this is a shore-based problem, and everyone turned into Martin Murphy and talk about how it has to be solved ashore. It may very well be ultimately solved ashore, but much of the impetus for that solution will come from the sea. With Marine and Navy power, I think we can't – we ignore this at our peril. The more we ignore it, the less the American public the less they will support us, and they'll say, "Why do we have a Navy if these folks in Somalia are able to cause so much trouble?"
Now, on that note, gentlemen, we have come to the tail end of our 2-hour, 1-year anniversary special. Eagle One, outstanding co-host this year. Thank you very much for jumping on a grenade now and then when I've had technology problems, just like we had this morning. But also Claude and Jerry, and also Galran, who's been with us from the beginning as well. Thank you very much for your support, your constructive criticism, and some great ideas that y'all have had for the show over the last year. And, of course, the usual suspects who've been out in force in the chat room. Thank you very much as well, everybody. And my thanks to you, Sal.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
Thank you very much. And we will be back again live next week. We're going to discuss the United States Marine Corps using the stepping off point brought by SecDef Gates last week. And our guest will be Dakota Woods, who's been there before. So, again, thank you very much, everybody. I've really enjoyed it. Look forward to the next year.
Hey, guys.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way.